Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
All right. Hello. Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I am your host, Jason Napolitano, and I am the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. And that is a book on basic meditation, an introduction to meditation. If you get a chance, please check it out. I'm on Amazon.com under If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, or at CosmicEye.org. And I have on the line Chris Sheridan, my co-host. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great. Great to be here, Jason.
Awesome. It's good to talk to you again. I love doing this every week with you, and I feel blessed that we get to dig down into some more Manly Hall stuff. Chris is the author of The Spirit in the Sky, and that book can be found on Amazon as well. Chris Sheridan, The Spirit in the Sky, or at Chris's website, chrissheridan.com. So we find ourselves on our 12th episode, and I'm excited about that, but I'm also excited because we spoke on your show yesterday. You have a new podcast, which will be up by the time they hear this episode, and it's called Living the Inner Life. And Chris talks about the inner life and its importance and cultivating a more spiritual approach to life. And I actually had the pleasure of being on that first episode with him. And I think it turned out pretty darn good, if I'm not speaking out of turn. So please check that out, Living the Inner Life with Chris Sheridan. And they can find that on iTunes or anchor.fm like we're doing our podcast here. Definitely encourage you guys to look for that. All right, so this week we're talking about Manly Hall again. We are continuing our study of the secret teachings of all ages. And I am using the Reader's Edition, and I think you have the same one, right, Chris? You're using the Reader's Edition?
Actually, I'm using
the big one?
PDF on the iPad, okay. Which is nice because I can highlight text, and I don't really want to run a highlighter through my original large book.
Gotcha.
So I'll look at the pictures on the big book, and then I'll do my writing and tinkering with the electronic version.
You are so much more technologically advanced than I am, because I am highlighting and scrolling into my book. But it is a little reader's edition one, and it's not the big book. I would find that sacrilegious to be
So. And that reader's edition is very good for that.
It's a perfect day. You know what's nice, and you know, like, I think what I should be doing, which I'm not, and what I would recommend the listener do, is have either the PDF version of it in front of you to work with, and you can, you know, go along with us in the book and follow along, reader's edition or that PDF version, the small version of the book, is much more manageable. And then to the side, you could have the big version if you have that. Whatever nice copy you might have of the hardcover, and you can look at the images and stuff that belong with that chapter, because they're such a huge part of the chapter. I mean, the images speak just volumes in terms of symbolism and beauty and getting to the heart of the teachings that Manly Hall is trying to share. So that's a great way to do it. This week, we're looking at Atlantis and the Gods of Antiquity, which is page 79 in the Reader's Edition that I'm working with. And it is 23 in the big book. It's XXIII, if you are not Roman numerally endowed. So that being said, we're going to jump right into this. First of all, Atlantis, I want to say, and you may feel the same way, is a fun subject. I dig it very much. My first exposure to the idea of Atlantis, I have to admit, was from, it was two sources actually that I still love today. Edgar Cayce's On Atlantis, I believe it's called. I had it here. Yeah, On Atlantis. And the Atlantis episode of In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. Did you see that?
I remember that
back
show.
In the day?
Definitely.
I loved that show, and it definitely shaped my interest and helped me to really develop an enthusiasm for these mysterious subjects, especially the one on Bigfoot, because I was born up in Seattle, and Bigfoot was a big thing in my youth. So we were still excited about that Bigfoot footage. and so on, which you can check out on YouTube. But I encourage anyone who's listening to read both Edgar Cayce's On Atlantis and also check out In Search Of on YouTube. Just put In Search Of Atlantis and the Leonard Nimoy will come up. It's, I think the History Channel owns it now and they have it up there for free. So that's fantastic. All right. And so actually we were talking a little bit earlier. Do you know some of the titles of the more current books on Atlantis that they can check out off the top of your head?
Well, sure. Older and more current ones. Manly Hall, obviously pulled from Plato's, Timaeus and the Crates, as we'll, I guess, get to soon. In the late 1800s, so maybe 25 years, 30 years before this book was published, Ignatius Donnelly wrote two books. One was Ragnarok, which has a lot of, fire and brimstone, cataclysms, earth pole shifts, things like that, which later would come out in Velikovsky's writings. And the other one was on Atlantis, but using a lot of scientific, at least at the time, available knowledge, as well as the kind of historic and mythical. But since then, in the 50s, Velikovsky wrote Worlds in Collision and Ages of Chaos, and probably the most relevant, Earth in Upheaval, which had to do with, again, these cataclysmic changes relating to the deluge, the Noah's flood, the world flood that really wreaked a lot of havoc and probably destroyed most of life on the planet. But recently, Graham Hancock is an author. I think Gary Lachman also writes about this. Numerous videos on YouTube. There's a guy, I forget his name. He does his YouTube channel is Bright Insight. He actually has a few videos on some very recent, using satellite mapping data, recent information on a possible location of Atlantis in the Saharan Desert. So it's very, very interesting. Yeah, this three-card structure that it's above ground, but it looks like it's one of those parts of the crust that maybe did sink and then rose up again later, like we can see in the Southwest. So anyway, it's very current again. It was current. It was interesting about 100 years ago. And I think there's just a renewed interest in it because on one hand, we're finding a lot of the scientific, archaeological and also like geological, the stones and bones are being pulled up and we're having to rethink. And what it does is it puts some of these older theories that seemed, pretty far out there. It puts them closer to being a possibility, like we know with the discovery of the remains of Troy. Everyone thought the Trojan War was in the Iliad was just myth, but they actually found the structure. Yeah. So,
exactly. That's an interesting point too, because we were going to speak a bit about that in terms of myth versus history, and how sometimes we see those two things as different, completely different categories. Whereas I think the ancient mind, in a lot of ways, when these things were being recorded, didn't see such a stark contrast between science and mythology. Actually, maybe saw them being more intertwined. One being, the myth being the meaningful and spiritual side of it, whereas the history being more the scientific or the kind of factual side of it. And I think the ancient mind was a little more skilled at maybe navigating that landscape than we are today, where we see these sharp binary sort of categories between myth and history, per se. So, I think that's an interesting thing. Manly Hall talks a little bit about that in the book and points out that he feels like the story that Plato the main story really where all of this Atlantis comes from is from Plato's writing in the Critias and Timaeus. Manly Hall finds allegory and history in, and he wanted to really point that out And I think that that's important. We have to remember today that things, for example, like in the Bible, there is historical evidence and there is archaeological evidence for much of what occurs in the stories of the Bible. And at the same time, then there's a deeper meaning, a mythological meaning to a lot of these events that we have to wrap our heads around it with a spiritual mindset, with a mythological mindset. And that's something that's more eternal. It's not in time. History is in time. It's in temporal, a temporal manifestation. Whereas mythology is something that's infinite and eternal that exists all the time. So I think that that's an important thing to look at when we're looking at this mythology and these ancient sources. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. Definitely. And yeah, like you said, I think the ancients knew both. They knew the exoteric and the esoteric. It took a more refined and more dedicated approach to this material to really understand and get to the esoteric, whereas the exoteric would have been valuable unto itself, but that which is easy to explain, or like the letter of the law, whereas the esoteric is more of the spirit of the law. It takes a little different mindset, and you have to be prepared for it, or you might just not see it.
Oh, exactly. And I think that that's where we find ourselves today when most of these, if you know, you tune into these shows oftentimes that, or these different documentaries that are made about these different sort of occult and esoteric phenomenon, mythologies, folklore, etc. And usually they're seeking scientific explanations or evidence to prove or disprove whether or not they are true, quote unquote. And I think that oftentimes we get lost in that sort of thinking. And then we've created this situation today, and we've talked about this many times, and I will talk about this ad nauseum because I think it's one of the most important issues of the day. Mythology, myth is not synonymous with untrue or fake. And we use that word disparagingly today. Oh, it's just a myth. Oh, it's just a myth, as if it means that it's not true. And give me that great definition of myth that you have.
Oh, a myth is a story.
From, I think, Jonathan.
Yeah, a myth is a story that never was, but always is.
But always is.
So maybe the allegory wasn't, whether or not you can find a historical confirmation that this person lived or that the boy actually did cry wolf. I don't know. Maybe that never happened. But the moral of the story, the mythic value,
and certainly happens
all the time.
It happens all the time, right? Yeah, exactly. That's a fantastic definition. Thank you. So we'll get right into the description, and we'll just kind of briefly touch on this because Manly Hall really outlines this well. This is on page 80 to 83, I think, or so, where he speaks about the Critias and Plato's work. And this is coming around, if I'm not mistaken, around 421 BC, something like this, 400 BC, when this book was written. Is that correct? Does that sound right?
About right.
Okay. So in the first ages, the gods divided the earth among themselves. This is an explanation of Atlantis. According to their respective dignities, each became the particular deity of his own allotment and established temples therein to himself, ordained a priestcraft, and instituted a system of sacrifice. To Poseidon was given the sea and the island. In the midst of the island was a mountain which was the dwelling place of three earthborn primitive human beings: Evanor, his wife Leucippe, and their only daughter Cleito. The maiden was very beautiful, and after a sudden death of her parents, she was wooed by Poseidon, who begat by her five pairs of male children. Poseidon apportioned his continent among these ten, and Atlas, the eldest, he made overlord of the other nine. Poseidon further called the country Atlantis and the surrounding sea the Atlantic in honor of Atlas. Before the birth of his ten sons, Poseidon divided the continent and the coastwise sea into concentric zones of land and water, which were as perfect as though turned upon a lathe, two zones of land and three of water surrounded by the central island, which Poseidon caused to be irrigated with two springs of water, one warm and the other cold. And we can see from that description, this is obviously mythological and allegorical. historical antecedents to it. So then he goes on to explain how the descendants of Atlantis continued on as the rulers of Atlantis, and explains how the government works, animals were domesticated, and so on. Really, essentially, he's laying out the case that Atlantis is more or less the first sort of organized, technologically advanced civilization with world trade and priestcraft and so forth. And he describes how all of that occurs, how all of it's laid out. One thing that's interesting about this that struck me was how he talks about the seven and the three. So there's seven small islands and three large ones. And then there's the central island, which contains the palaces, temples, and all the other public buildings. And then that is actually surrounded by a wall of gold, which was a sanctuary dedicated to Cleito and Poseidon. And then he describes the princes of the island, the tens and so forth, that of the leaders of these different groups and so on, and how they work together. And it's very interesting. There's a lot to think about there, and we're not going to be able to cover all of the symbolism of that, but it definitely has some very broad implications, which I find interesting. First of all, the seven starting the seven islands correspond to the seven ancient planets. Can you talk about that a little bit and some of the connections to that you saw?
Well, sure. I actually saw even more so in the Ishtar myth about the dying god, as far as the seven spheres, the seven orbits of the seven mm-hmm. planets. But again, it is a recurring theme. Basically, the seven will take an astrotheological tack on this. They correspond to the seven objects in the sky that we can see move relative to the background stars. That's the sun, the moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Those are naked eye observable. It would have been the same thousands of years ago as it is today. Our eyes have not improved or gotten worse, maybe, I don't know. Since then, we have telescopes and we can find more planets and moving objects. But so sure. That's, you know, that's very, that connects it when that's, they relate to the 7 days of the week. So it's really ingrained in our own, you know, keeping time and calendars. Of course, Sunday for Sunday, moon for Monday, and it goes on with different gods, Thor for Thursday, Saturn, Saturday, that they're named after. And the allegory, I guess the mythic connection, but it's even more than mythic. I mean, it's very, very personal and very spiritual in that embodiment into a human on the earth plane, like we are right now, that there was a process by which this, you know, universal spirit or this undifferentiated consciousness, whatever we were before we were born, that you had to go through these seven layers, these seven gates, these seven stations, and each one corresponding to a planetary orbit. And each time you add something, because spirit is kind of without materiality. So for it to, you know, become earthy and live in a human creature, it has to take on these layers. And you go down through the planets. So you have destruction, you have power, you know, Mars, you might have that warring capacity that we seem to have. Venus, we have the love capacity, and Mercury, our connection to the gods. And then the moon, which is the closest to the earth, that gives us this illusion anyway of constant change, because the moon phases change every day, every night. There's a new phase. But it's really kind of an illusion because the moon is just still there. It just looks different because the light is falling on it from a different angle. So it's all in duality, all those things. Those are these things that we pile on. And in a way, we become a lot less spiritual. We become seven layers removed from this undifferentiated spirit. But we need to do that to come in. And then the astrotheological viewpoint continues that after bodily death, then one by one, these layers are removed, and then you can return to a more spirited matter, but it's that seven, I mean, there's only what, 9, 10 numbers if you want to include zero. They're all magic. They all yep. have, you know,
sure,
scientific
sure.
as well as, you know, symbolic significance. But this seven is a huge, huge one, especially anything with seven rings.
Yeah. It makes that was a really great explanation of that. Thank you. The interesting thing too that I see here, kind of a correlation. First of all, the Tetractus of Pythagoras, where it's that the ten little digits or little circles in a sort of pyramid.
Think of a bowling. Bowling pins. Also, those are set up in a Tetractus.
Yeah, like bowling pins. Exactly. Exactly. You know, and you see the one at the top. And really the many come out of that one, and that signifies that, you know, there's a lot more symbolism than that. Obviously it's deeper than that, but it also has its connections to the Kabbalah in the 10 Sefirot, the 10 manifestations in the Tree of Life, the Etz Chaim, it's called in Hebrew. You have the top three, which are Keter, Chokmah, and Binah. And those are beyond what's called an abyss, basically. Those are sort of unknowable by us. But then below that, you have the seven. You have the seven Sephirot, which are the ones that we can actually make contact with. And if you look at it, there's a sort of a pattern of manifestation that comes down through those Sephirot, which resemble very much the ideas that we're talking about here. So that's an interesting correlation between those two things. The thing that I find interesting too about all of this, obviously there's so much here, but there's a lot of the interest in Atlantis centers around whether or not archaeological evidence can be found, and they've found certain things in certain places which they believe to be Atlantis. So it's off of Bimini, and you talked a bit about some new findings possibly in the Sahara, and you know, they've made different connections. One of the interesting things I think about that is, and Manly Hall points out quite a bit of it, is the idea really that the Atlanteans were sort of the forefathers of what we would call the secret doctrine or the secret wisdom, which sort of underlies all of our religious traditions and mythological traditions. And that in fact, with the destruction of Atlantis, which is talked about a bit. I think he ends the story actually at the end of the Critias, where the gods are getting together. Zeus has gotten the gods together, and I think they're speaking about what they're gonna do to the Atlanteans, because essentially the Atlanteans had become somewhat evil and they were bent on taking over the world. So the gods wanted to intervene and see that didn't happen. And he explains a little bit about the destruction and so on. The idea is that Atlantis, of course, was destroyed by some sort of cataclysmic event, either a flood or volcanic activity, possibly earthquakes, what have you. So they, you know, the modern search is for, you know, remains, evidences of that culture. One of the things that Don Hall does in Secret Teachings is to sort of connect some of the similarities. Egypt and some of the New World, quote unquote, New World civilizations in Mesoamerica, the Mayan civilization, the Aztecs, and the pre-Columbian native groups that were in, you know, Central and parts of South America, where they find pyramid building, and they find things like serpents and crosses. He speaks about how the Atlanteans actually were the sort of originators of those cultures. In other words, wherever it found any evidence of sort of physical manifestations that they think might be Atlantis, there's never any bodies found. So that the idea is that there was a dispersion of these people, and they went out amongst the world, and anywhere you find high technology cultures that seem to not fit in the area, it's explained by the fact that was probably brought by Atlanteans. And that, you know, and then he speaks about, you know, how there's a lot of legends and myths where people came out of the sea and brought technology and culture and arts and crafts to the people. and so forth. I found that very interesting. Did you enjoy that part? I like that part of the book.
Well, I did. And, you know, even if you're a skeptic, and I really have been with the Atlantis theory for years, it took a lot of studying and, you know, confronting some of my doubts and some logical thinking before I leaned more towards the Atlantean hypothesis. But this notion of this, you know, diaspora, this you know, emanating out, part of the legend goes on that, yes, they were technologically superior, but that sort of got the better of them. And I think this is an allegory for maybe where we are now. We're at a peak so far in this civilization as being technologically adept. But with AI and out of control robots and some of these other things on the horizon, we're losing touch with the more human element, maybe relying more on these things and really losing our way. And if we pray to this technological God, we're really not going to get really anything good out of it. So it's quite possible that their technology got the best of them. Maybe they blew something up and that triggered an earthquake that then shifted the crust. And then we have this deluge and, you know, maybe it's all related. Who knows? Yeah. But it's, the allegory is definitely clear.
That's actually, yeah, exactly. And that what you just spoke about now is in Edgar Casey's On Atlantis. He talks about a great war and actually having some sort of technology, maybe very similar to an atomic bomb or something of that magnitude, where they actually caused the damage that happened to them, or they caused the cataclysm that was their own destruction with the technology that they had, which is quite possible. I mean, it would, you know, it doesn't take a stretch of the imagination to think, for example, if we let loose all of the nuclear weapons that we possess just in the United States, it would be quite possible to obliterate nearly every vestige of our culture and technology in almost an instant. And it would be melted and decimated and atomized to the point where you would find no evidence of us in the future. You know, 10,000, 100,000, 400,000 years from now, if the Earth survived such a cataclysm, you would see nothing of our culture, I would imagine. Or it would be covered over with sands and it would be buried under lava. And you know what I'm saying? So to think that there's no, you know, there's no possible antecedents or no cultures which might have been more technologically advanced than we are, I think is kind of a stretch in a sense. Just because you don't have physical evidence does not mean that something was not here that destroyed itself also. I mean, that has to be taken into account. If we can do it, it's possible that someone else figured it out before and already did that. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I do. So we can even take a lesson from just the last 500 years, which is very much in the recorded history of our peoples, that people did come from the sea. They came from, you know, of course, beyond the horizon. But when, you know, Cortez and, you know, the conquistadors, sure, and Columbus and, you know, these folks are moving into new areas, they do have... They have horses, they have gold, they have, or well, actually the gold is already here. They have, you know, things, armor, shiny metal, armor. Weapons, far superior weapons. Sure. We definitely brought that, diseases, you know, all kinds of things. So that's already happened. I mean, that clearly has happened in recent history. That, you know, once the Europeans got, you know, technologically advanced enough with seafaring that they were able to make an Atlantic crossing. Or perhaps the Chinese did, going the other way, for a more Western approach. But it did come from the sea. That's, you know, so that it's not to say that, though, this is a myth and that's a superstition or a religious belief. Well, it's based in truth that we can prove historically that this kind of thing happens. So why wouldn't it have happened before?
Sure. That's a good point. A more recent history. The second portion of this, I don't want to move away from Atlantis, but there is so much in this particular section, and the whole Atlantis mythology and sort of search is a huge endeavor unto itself, and still a very popular one. There's a lot of great resources out there. Donnelly's book, of course, on Atlantis. What is it called? Atlantis.
The Antediluvian World.
The Antediluvian. Yeah, exactly.
Great title. Meaning the big flood, which was probably, yeah. And archaeologically, there's so much more evidence, even though Manly Hall does mention that the sinking of Atlantis might correspond with Noah's flood, as it's known in the West, or this cataclysmic deluge that happened at the end of the Ice Age, the most recent Ice Age. That's pretty much scientifically believed, that there was a global catastrophe that happened around 11,000 BCE, something like that. And that fit in, with the timeline. So it is something that, again, there's, even since the secret teachings was written, there is a lot more scientific evidence to lend towards this. So
yeah, I'm sure there'll be more interesting. Exactly. And there, of course, do a search on YouTube or in Google if you want to get more information about Atlantis. But a great place to start if you're just starting out is this chapter in the Secret Teachings. He really does touch on a lot of the more important aspects of today. People are taking small points of things that Manly Hall was talking about many, many years ago and extrapolating them out into books and, narrative stories and documentaries and so on. So this is a great place to start. Then maybe Donnelly's work and perhaps Edgar Cayce's work on Atlantis, and then some of the newer stuff. You talked about some of those authors at the beginning. So go back and check that out at the beginning of the episode if you want to get Chris's list of that, of those books. And, there's much more to do in this area, obviously, than we have time to do. But the last section we wanted to touch on was that section that you touched on briefly that includes the Ishtar myth. Tammuz and Ishtar's myth starts out the myth of the dying god section. And it seemed kind of strange. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but it almost feels like he tacked this on at the end of this section, and you're not quite sure why until you really start to all together. And I think that it has something to do with that astrotheology connection that you were talking about. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how this fits into Atlantis, the myth of the dying god and astrotheology and so forth?
Well, sure. In a way, you could even look at Atlantis itself as a dying god. And there are so many. We are familiar with Osiris, who was betrayed and chopped up into pieces by his brother Set. And so definitely dying. But then it's also then this reconstruction. Mithras, there are so many other dying gods. Jesus.
Bacchus.
Is one, Bacchus.
Yeah.
So many. And it's not so much that they died. That's not really the point. And in most of these cases, if not all of them, this death isn't the end. It's not really the physical mortal death, although that does get played out in the Christian tradition. The important thing is that it's a symbolic death. And after this death, that there is some redemptive or restorative act or action that has to take place. And then the pieces can be put back together in the case of Osiris, or the spear can be pulled out, that the body can be reconstructed. And it's really the structure of the soul, of the character of the person that gets killed in the sense that you're losing maybe, and this is probably something that happens to, many of us maybe more towards midlife, where we've actually had this physical, very visceral, life of things and things to do and everything. And maybe it becomes more contemplative, or that we've maybe experienced a lot of stuff. Maybe we're not as young as we were to maybe physically do that. So the temptations and the interest in some of the daily pleasure things aren't quite as you don't really want to go out to the bar. You can't just, you know, like when you're 19 or 21 or something, you're like, oh my gosh, sure. It's Friday night. We got to go out and party. And it's, you don't really feel it that much when you're, you know, a couple decades later.
You don't feel as drawn and pushed towards that kind of need to party that you did when you were younger, for sure. Absolutely.
And then the interest is shifted into more, you know, affairs of the heart, or what can I do for my community? You know, raising kids, you know, things like that.
Sure.
It becomes, you know, the priorities shift and they become different, and maybe more like a tycoon or some, you know, cutthroat businessman will, you know, be out there in the physical world and materially, you know, concocting ways to make fortunes. And then later on in life, they become a philanthropist, and then their whole day is spent, how do I give away all this money that I made? So
yeah,
this is,
that's an interesting way to put that. Yeah.
So well, you know, he talks
about that, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but Manly Hall talks about that as the philosophic death and the philosophic resurrection, and he compares those to the lesser and greater mysteries. And I think that's an interesting way to look at that.
And the philosophic death, we can look at that as being, if you relate it to like baptism. The baptism by water is like the physical rebirth. you know, being dunked in the water is kind of symbolic of, you know, letting that go. And then you come back and your first breath is, now I'm a saved person, if that's, you know, the tradition. And then the dying on the cross is more of the symbolic and philosophic, or the rebirth of the spirit, of the baptism
spirit.
Of spirit. That is what gets renewed. The body stays alive throughout this. Now, it may feel like the dark night of the soul and that you're losing everything and it's all falling apart. And maybe it does fall apart because maybe it needs to, if you're at a certain stage in your life that maybe you do want to have other priorities. But it's philosophically dying to the world. It's a very Buddhist notion, too, of detachment. Is really what you're doing. You know, you can meditate on your body just like melting like a candle out in the heat, that, you know, it's just everything, even the bones are just stripped down into nothing, and you have a puddle on the ground and even that gets evaporated, that this kind of non-self, you know, that you're all these things that really aren't you, that maybe you thought were really
sure,
important.
Exactly.
They can be sacrificed. They can be nailed to the cross because they belong to that world of materiality. And we have to shed ourselves of that. And it may feel like dying because we may give up some pleasures or things that we did for so many years. But it's also because we want to do this. We want to transcend and transform. In alchemy, it's changing the lead, you know, into the gold.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Great way to describe that. Thank you. You know, just to kind of wrap this up, since we don't have too much time left, it seems that one of the big points that Manly Hall is trying to make is that, in fact, you know, the secret wisdom that we have today from the different traditions and from the different religious, especially the ancient stuff, does have, and he sees that as being Atlantis, and that's tied into even some of our modern religious beliefs today. And I wanted to kind of end the show to give the listener something to think about. I'm going to read this very last paragraph, which is on page 91, and how this kind of ties it all together in terms of the importance of the philosophic death and the philosophic resurrection. This is not to say that, you know, Jesus was not born and died and was bodily resurrected. That's really not an issue. Kind of in a sense, the way they say, if you meet the Buddha in the middle of the road, kill him, because it's not a point whether or not Buddha or was a historical figure or not. It's the philosophical and spiritual lessons that we can learn from them and apply to our own human existence today. That's the important thing. So let me just read this Manly Hall quote here at the end. Isn't a quote, but a paragraph here at the end of this chapter, Atlantis and the Gods of Antiquity, from page 91. From a consideration of all these ancient and secret rituals, it becomes evident that the mystery of the dying god was universal among the illumined and venerated colleges of the sacred teaching. This mystery has been perpetuated in Christianity in the crucifixion and death of the God-man Jesus the Christ. The secret import of this world tragedy and the universal martyr must be rediscovered if Christianity is to reach the heights attained by the pagans in the days of their philosophic supremacy. The myth of the dying God is the key to both universal and individual redemption and regeneration. And those who do not comprehend the true nature of this supreme allegory are not privileged to consider themselves either wise or truly religious. Deep stuff. So think on that. And thank you for joining us again on the Cosmic Eye Show. I'm your host, Jason Napolitano. And I am the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. And I have on the phone with me, as I do each week, co-host Chris Sheridan, who is the author of The Spirit in the Sky. And both of our books can be found on Amazon or either cosmiceye.org or chrissheridan.com, respectively. Thank you, Chris, for being here again. I always appreciate your insights. You had some really great points this week. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. We'll tune in next week. We will have another great episode. And thanks for joining us. Have a great week. God bless.
Thank you for listening. And please join us next Sunday for a new episode of Cosmic Eye. You can purchase If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate at Amazon.com or through our website, cosmiceye.org.